Simon. Diamond Shaman. But to tonight now, and it's part two of our thrilling space adventure by cult author Piers Anthony. The spaceship Meg 2 is hurtling towards the rim of the universe, and the crew are close to mutiny.
The Ghost Galaxies by Piers Anthony. Part 2. Somnanda's brow wrinkled. I am not entirely familiar with this theory. Is there something about it that affects the nature of our voyage? Shetland smiled inwardly. In Somnanda's view, the purpose of this journey was merely to test the beacon. The validity of one theory of the universe or another would have little bearing on that, unless one theory embodied an inherent threat to the beacon. That threat was real enough, but it stemmed from internal problems, not external. The evolutionary theory is one of several evolved, again, no pun, to explain the observed state of the universe, Shetland explained. There are numberless clusters of galaxies in view of Earth, each retreating from every other one. The situation can only be explained by postulating a general expansion of the entire cosmos. But the nature of this expansion is open to doubt. This particular theory has all matter originating in a gigantic nucleus 5 billion years ago. When it exploded... Now I understand, Somnanda said. That would make every galaxy approximately the same age. I had assumed that the more distant ones were older. They may well be, Shetland said. The information we are gathering now may answer that question when we return to Earth. But it is my conjecture that this theory is invalid, because we have already passed the furthest limit the evolutionary universe could have reached, and the pattern has not changed. Would this be reason to frighten the cartographer? Shetland paced the floor. I don't understand why. That's what holds me back. The elimination of a single theory should be of no more consequence than the elimination of an invalid strategy in the course of a chess game. An inconvenience, certainly, but hardly frightening. Unless the alternative is more dangerous. The obvious alternative at this point would be the steady-state theory, which has galaxies continuously forming and being formed outward by the constant appearance of new matter. Since there is no beginning, the universe is steady in space and time and does not evolve. Individual galaxies, however, would evolve, and we should discover old ones as well as new ones. And the universe would be somewhat larger. Larger? Because the evolutionary universe would be in its infancy, limited by the 5 billion year span since the explosion. But the average galaxy will survive for 10 times that length of time, and if we assume the expansion to be exponential, the universe could eventually attain a radius of 10,000 teraparsecs, give or take a decimal or two. Somnanda digested this. 1 teraparsec is 1,000,000 megs. But our drive will take us there in just 30 hours. That would be the size of the steady-state universe, since it is not in its infancy. If my conjecture is correct, the cartographer actually should understand such things better than I. He is attempting to map the universe. Perhaps he knows something that we do not. Shetland paced the floor again. He never mentions steady state. It was as though it didn't exist for him. Possibly he has reason for his fear. This should be ascertained. What decision had the captain of the Meg 1 made? Had he waited until 30 hours to question his beacon? Or had some unthinkable menace consumed his ship at the rim of the steady state cosmos? The decision of the prior captain had been wrong. How could Shepard improve upon it in his ignorance? The ship's clock stood at 25 when Beaton entered the beacon room. Reporting as directed, sir. Shetland was afraid to waste time. He watched the candle as he spoke. I believe you are afraid of something, Beaton, and it is important for me to understand. Such emotion affects the beacon. Beaton met him with a steady gaze in which there was not a trace of fear. May I speak frankly, sir? When a crewman felt it necessary to address that question to the captain, the result was seldom pleasant. You are directed to do so. I'd like to rephrase the question, Beaton said, dropping the sir. He was intelligent and had probably anticipated this session. I think I'm afraid of the same thing you are. Will you admit that much? I'm afraid of many things. Continue. We fear a very real danger, and it has nothing to do with the beacon. You and I know that there is death waiting for us at the edge of the universe. One ship has already been taken, perhaps others. Somnanda looked up but held his peace. The important thing to realize is that this was no freak accident. We face the same demise unless we reverse the drive. No, Shatton said simply. Johns poked his head in the entrance. Am I interrupting something? He inquired. My assistant took over long enough for me to inquire. You should listen to this, Beaton said with authority. Somnanda nodded. Shatton glanced from one to the other. Was there a mute agreement between them? How many were anxious to abort the mission? The situation was uncomfortable. Johns also seemed to be ill at ease. Look, if you want me to go... Shatton took command. Mr. Beaton believes that our course leads to danger. He is about to explain his reason for his request that the Meg be reversed prematurely. There was silence. Was the beacon flickering more violently than before? Whose tension was responsible? Go on, Beaton, Shatton said firmly. The cartographer swallowed. A nervous young man, now that it had come to the point. The flame was brighter. You are familiar with the steady-state cosmos, he said, jumping, as the record advised, to an accurate conclusion. I had expected this theory to be eliminated by our findings. I had hoped... He looked at the increasing flame, then averted his gaze. To most people, there is a small difference between one concept of the universe and another. After all, it has no discernible effect on our daily lives. But to those of us who voyage into the extraordinary reaches, it becomes a matter of life and death. Say what you mean, Shatton growled. At the center, where the galaxies are young, we are safe. But at the rim, they are old. Beyond the rim... He paused in the yellow light. Beyond the rim, they are dead. He looked at each of the others in turn, and met only bafflement. Well, don't you see? They have passed on. There is nothing beyond the rim but ghosts, the malignant spirits of once living galaxies. Shetland looked at Somnanda, who shook his head negatively. He looked at Johns, whose mouth was hanging open. You're crazy, Johns said. Beaton jumped up, and the flame leapt with him. No, no, he cried. You have to understand. You have to stop the ship before it's too late. The supernatural is no threat to us, Shetland snapped. Captain... Somnanda's voice was urgent. Shetland whipped round. The beacon had burst into an inferno, destroying itself.
Stop the ship!
Beaton screamed.
The ghost is out there!
Suddenly, Shetland's sidearm was in his hand. The tableau seemed to freeze at the moment. Somnanda in the corner, half-standing, agony on his face, sweat shining in the orange glow. Johns, staring at the young cartographer, confusion and incredulity distorting his own features, scalp red under the thin hair. Beaten, standing with one fist in the air, mouth insanely wide, lips pulled back from teeth. One word from the captain would ease this threat. He had only to agree to stop the ship, to set aside his orders. Then, Beaten was falling, engulfed in a sparkling cloud. The gas from the capsule Shetland had fired was dissipating already, but Beaten would be in a deep coma for at least 12 hours, far past the crisis point. Captain... Somnanda's voice cut through his reverie, as it always did. There is little doubt that the young man's terror was the cause of the disturbance, but it should have abated had you agreed to reverse the drive. The flame was normal. I could not do that. Johns made a sound.
You knew how simple it was to stop the trouble, and you killed him anyway.
Yes. Johns stared at him with the same expression he had turned on Beaton before. Captain, now I'm not so sure Beaton was the crazy one. Maybe he was right. You never let him make his point. Shetland looked at the unconscious form, so peaceful now. If I had verified his suspicion, Pilot, his terror would certainly have extinguished the beacon.
Verified his...
Johns was shocked.
You admit it. There is a ghost out there.
Not a ghost. A ship. A ship that ceased contact suddenly. My orders are to investigate. I shall investigate.
By heading straight into the same trap.
Those are my orders.
Orders?
The flame was rising again.
Captain, I can't agree to that.
Shepland studied him sourly. You can't agree, Pilot.
No, I can't. That ghost will eat us too. We've got to turn back.
Besides the growing flame, Somnanda's head turned to bear on John's.
I see it now, the pilot said. Beaton was right. After the galaxies die, they're ghosts, and they hate the living.
He looked around, saw the flame.
Don't you understand? We must reverse the ship.
The flash, the sparkle, the dissipation, and the pilot joined the cartographer. The flame subsided.
Somnanda and Shepland looked at each other. Your move, Captain.
The chess game. Somnanda could think of that at this juncture.
I only hope my personal situation is better than that of my pieces, he said. I will have to consider my move. Your situation is good, Somnanda said cryptically.
Shepland hauled the two unconscious men to the side of the cabin.
I think it best to keep these out of sight of the other crewmen for the time being, he said. Then, sensing Somnanda's curiosity, it may seem unreasonable to sacrifice two human beings in this fashion, rather than accede to their rather simple request. But I can delegate their functions if necessary. I could neither humor their fancies nor allow their emotional stress to destroy the beacon.
Yes. He felt the need to justify himself to Somnanda and cursed his own frailty.
You seem unreasonable.
From this man, this was an observation, not an insult.
I am unreasonable. Sometimes that is the only course, just as an apparently illogical sacrifice is at times required in order to win at chess.
The chess analogy kept running through his mind. Was it valid?
Somnanda waited. Extended trips into FTL have been rare so far, Shepland continued. Evidence is therefore inconclusive, and there appears to be a certain distortion in many personalities as velocity increased. Perhaps it is a side effect of the drive, or simply an emotional reaction to isolation from the normal universe. But it is one of my dreads, and I always watch for it. That's why I'm careful about revealing my orders prematurely. Individual judgment cannot be trusted in FTL. Normal people are apt to become aware of it. It is futile to point out such aberrations to the victims. They are, in effect, mental patients. I think you have seen some of this now.
Yes.
The captain is not excluded, Shepland said, smiling wearily. I have preoccupations, and I entertain doubts. I question the wisdom of this voyage, its apparent expendability, the attitude of certain crewmen, the evidence of the supernatural. I do not believe, at this moment in the beacon, that is, that it represents any valid connection with Earth. But if it is real, why not the ghost of a galaxy? I do anticipate extinction at the 30th hour, but I will not reverse the drive.
I understand.
Because my own judgment is suspect, I can rely on only one thing to be objective, my orders. These were presented to me before the voyage began, and were reasonable then. They must be reasonable now. If I desire to modify them, it is because my present insight is biased, not my earlier one. I must therefore uphold what seems unreasonable to me. And I shall.
The clock read 28.8 hours. 1 teraparsec per second. Soon the voyage would really be over, one way or another. Shepland found himself in Beaton's room, looking at the chess set. Why had he come? Because there was a lingering uncertainty as the 30th hour approached? Or simple guilt for overriding that uncertainty? He saw a picture of Alice, smiling for a man she might never see again. Would she be widowed before her marriage,
all because a certain captain's orders meant more to him than his common sense? It was uncanny, the way in which the young man had divined the moves and kept up with a game the captain had never advertised. But this was a private game. He swept the pieces into the box, folded the board. Beneath it was a paper previously hidden. Shetland picked it up and saw a series of notations. They seemed to represent the strategy of a game in progress. His game? He applied the notes to the game in his mind. They checked. But the moves were not as he would have made them. They started at the present position, but the style was radically different. Beaton had said he could win with white, and these notes incredibly proved it. Beginning with a highly questionable queen sacrifice, white forged to a forced advantage in the game's 30th move. The series violated many of the tenets of good positional play, yet he saw now was quite valid. He would not use it, of course. The genius was not rightfully his. But he would show this interesting lesson to Somnanda, how independent and bold foresight could convert a certain loss into victory. Book play was not always valid. By the 30th move. Coincidence? Or a message that his stupidity had prevented Beaton from delivering? Was it natural to assume that such a brilliant mind had been mistaken in the one case that counted? Or had the cartographer's terrible fear been based on fact, not fancy, while the distortion merely prevented him from making himself sufficiently clear? Had Johns also finally responded to the actual message, seen its validity? Assume for the sake of argument that Beaton had been right, that death did wait at the 30th hour, that the situation was hopeless because the man in charge refused to deviate from the book, from his orders, no matter what. In chess, the answer had been a total revision of strategy. The book had to be thrown away. In life? The chessboard image in his mind faded into a figurative map of the universe. Galaxies of the steady state hurtled outward, born in the center as pawns, dying of old age at the rim as kings. And then, as it were, the pieces came to life. The pawns were babies, the kings old men. The board, which was the universe, became a city without buildings. The babies were born spontaneously in the center and crawled busily in all directions. As they made their way outward, they grew into children, and some had bishops' hats, and some had horses' heads. Farther out, they developed into men and women, and the men were castles, and the women queens. Finally, the old king staggered to the rim to die. The size of this city was governed by the age of the inhabitants. Where they became too old to go out farther, the city ended. Most of them died at 50 moves. The rim was a desolate grave. There was no one to bury the bodies. Where they fell, they lay. They rotted. And the white bones guarded the memory of what had been. Then, incredibly, a child appeared at the rim. By some freak, it had bypassed age and entered the domain of death long before its time. A child named Meg. The ancient bones quivered with rage. No living thing should be allowed to desecrate the mighty graveyard. The angry spirits gathered their forces, concentrated their ghastly energies, opened their ponderous jaws, and said, "Captain, Captain." It was Somnanda. Shetland shook himself awake to see the beacon room. The yellow light was rampaging again, and this time he himself was the cause.
"Reverse the drive!"
he shouted into the intercom. Now it was 16.49. But it was speed, not time. Once more, the captain of the Meg 2 stood behind the pilot, pretending that nothing had happened.
"Captain," John said. "Captain, I want to say something."
What was there for this man to say? That he resented being gassed, then revived to learn that his assistant had reversed the drive at 29.34 on the orders of that same captain who had shot the pilot down for urging this?
"Captain, I just want to apologize. I don't know what came over me. I never lost my head like that before. I don't believe in ghosts. I just... somehow I couldn't... What I mean is, you did the only thing you could do. And I can see that you were right all the time. I'm sorry, I forgot."
Johns was apologizing for his own distortion. now that it had abated with the speed of the ship, and he was able to see it for what it was, a distortion that was not his own fault. We were all a little on edge, Shevlin said, discovering that his dislike of the pilot was gone. Was there any point in trying to explain? 16.36. 13 hours of deceleration. With the Meg 2 travelling at only a tenth its former speed with every hour that the clock subtracted, and still approaching a rendezvous of terror with fantastic velocity, 29 hours deceleration would bring it to a halt in space, at almost the exact spot they would have passed in the 30th hour of acceleration. The exponential series that was the drive was a remarkable thing. 16.34. Only when they came to a dead halt, relative to their starting point, could they release the drive and apply the chemical maneuvering rockets in order to turn the ship around and begin the home journey. Then back, accelerating once more to... Hell broke loose. The ship bucked violently, flinging Chetlin to the far wall. Shooting pains went through his left shoulder as another upheaval bounced him on the floor. An agonized keening sounded in his ears, and a red fog clouded his brain, seeming to obscure all vision above the horizontal. Dimly he saw the pilot's legs wrapped around the bolted-down stool. Johns, more alert than his captain, had held his position. There was the smell of burning insulation in the air.
"Cut the drive!"
Shetland roared. He tried to stand up, but the heaving room brushed him aside. The clamor of the suit alert began. The hull had been pierced.
"Captain!"
John's voice drifted back from a far distance.
"We're in FTL. We can't. Cut the drive!"
John's moved his hand, and miraculously the ship was quiet. Shetland lurched to his feet, heedless of the pain. The alarm had ceased. Someone must have repaired the damage already. That man would get a commendation. Shetland's hands, of their own volition, groped for and found the archaic regulation fire extinguisher, not obsolete after all, as smoke curled up from the panel. Suddenly, the unit was blasting noxious foam all over his boots. He turned it, already feeling the biting cold. Crystals of ice flew off like broken glass as he tramped towards the control panel.
"Stop, Captain!"
John said.
"No need! No need! The power is off!"
Shetland lowered the extinguisher. Now he had time to assess his injuries. Pain, for the moment, was masked. It was there, but the enormity of it would only be felt later. He was surprised to discover no blood. He felt along his left arm, realizing that the trouble with the extinguisher had been due to his one-handed control. The left hand was useless, though there were no breaks.
"Captain!"
Why did he always drift into contemplation, even in a crisis?
"Captain!"
The pilot's voice was shocked. "The instruments are registering." "That's what they're for," Shetland said shortly. "But we're in FTL." Johns, so capable in the crisis, was now falling apart.
"The drive is off. The shield is down. Why aren't we dead?"
Shetland had understood the situation the moment the ship bucked, but he was not certain he could explain it to the pilot readily. Johns might have difficulty accepting the truth.
"Do you believe in ghosts?" he inquired.
Johns stiffened. He had already denied superstition. Shetland sympathized, but this was necessary.
"No, sir,"
the pilot said.
"Look at your instruments," Shetland commanded. "Tell me what's out there."
Johns looked.
"We're approaching an object of galactic scope at just under the speed of light. Approximate mass..."
he faltered.
"Go on, pilot."
"Sir, I think the instrument is broken,"
Shetland replied with deliberate cruelty.
"Do I have to teach you elementary navigation? Where are the warning lights? You know the instrument is not broken."
"But it can't be."
"Don't argue. What does it say?"
Johns seemed to shrink inside himself. His lips stretched to form the words his mind rejected.
It says, "The galaxy we're approaching has no mass."
Shetland smiled grimly.
"I ask you again, do you believe in ghosts?"
"Yes,
there is a ghost," Shetland said,
as the Meg-2's hull vibrated to the impact of her chemical propulsion. She was maneuvering for a position to begin the return voyage. The four of them were in the beacon room again, watching the steady flame. All of us had some hint of the truth, Shepherd said. But we were blinded by our separate conceptions of the mission and by our mutual dread of the unknown. We tried to exclude the supernatural, not realizing that when the supernatural is understood, it becomes natural. Cartographer Beaton was closest to it.
But I wasn't able to face emotionally what my intellect showed me, Beaton said. The thing is so incredible.
I still don't follow you, Johns protested.
We're alive, and there's a thing out there. I'll admit that much, but nothing in the universe is solid enough to rock a ship in high FTL, and we were at 16.34. That's a light year per second. But we were battered so badly that a crate of beans broke loose and shoved itself through the hole. I tried to, he laughed. Wouldn't that be an epitaph for a lost ship? Torpedoed by a can of beans in FTL.
I, too, am perplexed, Somnanda said. I understood that it was certain destruction to drop the shield while in FTL. Solid matter cannot exist at a light year per second. We phased in with the ghost, Shepherd said. Beaton, things are clearer. Finish your explanation. Beaton plunged in happily. As I was trying to say at an earlier occasion, but somehow couldn't quite put into sensible words, at the center of things, a galaxy is young, but in the course of 50 billion years or so, it ages. And, like an aging man, it changes. For one thing, it puts on weight, becomes sluggish. A galaxy in its late prime is an unbelievably massive thing, so dense that its surface gravity prevents its own light from escaping. Within it, nevertheless, breakdown continues, and the prisoned energies, well, we have had no experience with such a state. Eventually, all matter is gone, but there is still no escape for that phenomenal complex of energy. We are left with a galaxy whose material portion has passed away, but which still exists as an entity, a ghost.
The ghost of a galaxy, John said. But that shouldn't affect...
You forgot that the ghost is moving, Shepherd said. That un-galaxy is travelling at rim velocity, 16.04 ship's clock. There is no other...
Which means it determines stasis for this area of space, Johns explained. Velocity is meaningless in the void. It has to be relative to some mass or...
Or some ghost, Beaton put in. Apparently our laws of physics change here. We've discovered a lot more than a galaxy.
So we decelerated to within light speed of the ghost, and the shield came down automatically and left us in normal space. Even at the fringe, those energies were overloading the drive.
Johns paused.
But what would have happened if we had landed inside the ghost?
Or even travelled through it in FTL, Somnanda said.
Shepherd considered.
I suspect the nature of space itself is altered within the ghost. The Meg-1 did unwittingly enter it.
There was silence as the implication sank in. Was this the final evidence that man was limited after all, in spite of his limitless ambition, hemmed in by numberless and deadly ghosts? Or was their very existence a new challenge, greater than any before? What would the first explorers find when they parked their fleet and penetrated carefully the fringe of that monster?
Captain, Shetland looked up. Your move, Captain.
Stephen Hogan was reading The Ghost Galaxies by Piers Anthony. The producer was Gemma Jenkins.